today I wanted to discuss, I discussed with you last time the Abarbanel, and today I want to discuss, so to speak, the fallout of what happened, Gerush Sfarad, of the Jews being expelled from Spain, its effect on both the Sfardim and on the Ashkenazim, because it had a profound effect. I would say that until the Holocaust, until World War II, after the Churban Bayis Rishon, Churban Bayis Sheni, after the destruction of the Second Temple, the two main cataclysmic, terrible events in Jewish history that occurred would be the expulsion of the Jews from Spain and Gzeres Tach V'Tat, the destruction of Eastern European Jewry in 1648 and 1649, in terms of numbers and in terms of the effect. Now, we're talking about a time of constant persecution, you know, like pogroms, but that's like the regular, you know, like we get used to the Intifada, so that, a few bombs a day, mortars in Gaza, and all of these things, so we're accustomed to it. So it really doesn't, you know, if 5 years ago, or 10 years ago, or 20 years ago, it may have shocked us. Today, when you're accustomed to it, so it doesn't have that effect. So the pogroms didn't have that effect either. They don't have a cataclysmic effect on the Jewish people. No one says the world is coming to an end because the Christians make a pogrom in Easter or on Good Friday. But these two events are so large and they cover such an enormous event, because now you're dealing with hundreds of thousands of people. You're not dealing just with a localized event. And therefore, they had tremendous influence, and they continue to have influence today. I don't think that you can really understand the Jewish world today unless you understand what happened then, because it's like the Big Bang Theory. So the physicists hear the echo of the Big Bang now, who knows how many years later, how many centuries later, how many millennia later. There's an echo in history also. And this echo affects us. It influences us. When the Jews left Spain, so I said half the Jews converted to Christianity and half the Jews left. Out of the half the Jews that left, about 250,000, about 50,000 died on the road. They were subject to all sorts of predations. The ships were captured by pirates. They were held for ransom. They starved to death. They were beset by robbers. Plague took a great amount of them because they didn't have sanitary conditions. They didn't have much food, and because of the fact that they were wanderers, refugees. And there was no one to take care of them except the Jewish communities, which attempted to help them. Most of these Jews ended up in the Mediterranean basin, ended up in North Africa, Turkey, Greece, especially Salonika, in Italy. I discussed with you that the Abarbanel became the Minister of Finance for the King of Naples, and that he died in Italy, he's buried in Italy near Florence. Some of them came to the land of Israel. A few thousand came to the land of Israel. And those that came to the land of Israel came with messianic expectations. Because any time that there is a terrible tragedy in the Jewish world, it always raises messianic expectations. It's ikvasa de Mashiach. It's the pain of labor, of giving birth. And therefore, the great trouble of always brings about messianic expectations. This messianic expectation, which began in 1492, combined with what happened the Eastern European Jewry in 1648 and 1649, created the background for Shopsai Tzvi in the late 1650s and 1660s to be able to convince a third of the Jewish people that he was the Messiah, even though he was a sham, a faker. He was probably mentally ill. He was a manic depressive. So when he was manic, he could go 3 days, 4 days without sleeping. And when he was depressed, he didn't get out of bed. And when he didn't get out of bed, he said he was meditating. He was thinking about God. So today we have names, we have medical names for all of these things. But in the 17th century, there were no medical names for it. And therefore, people believed that he was holy, that he was the Messiah, etc. And that brought about a tremendous disaster, because no Messiah is better than a false Messiah. The false Messiah saps all of your strength and all of your belief. And it's a little like the only thing I could say on this is that, you know, when the Mashiach comes, as he undoubtedly will come, he'll have a hard time proving himself. The Jewish people will be very, very wary. And that's especially true since we know nothing about Mashiach. I mean, the only thing we know is that it'll be Hungarian, but otherwise... we really know nothing about him, right? And because of that, therefore, in Yiddish there's a great phrase, "Mibritzach avheise blost men avkalte," meaning that if you burned your tongue on hot soup, then you blow, even on cold, even on cold fruit soup, you blow. We've burned our tongue so many times on false messiahs that when the real one comes, the Jewish people are skeptical. And maybe that's the way it's supposed to be. I mean, it's certainly the way it's supposed to be. It's the way the Lord has ordained it. And anyway, so the Sephardic Jews live all over the Mediterranean basin. And they live in a Muslim society, in an Arab society. The Jews that live in Greece live in a Christian society, Greek Orthodox. But none of them, almost none of them, except those that lived in Italy, none of them are subject to the Roman Catholic Church. And the Roman Catholic Church is the fount of all anti-Semitism. It has not improved that much today yet. And its anti-Semitism is theological, but it also has terrible racial overtones to it. And the Roman Catholic Church kept on persecuting the few hundred thousand Jews that converted to Christianity and remained in Spain. And the Inquisition was basically an Inquisition not against Jews who professed themselves to be Jews, as it was against Jews who said they were Christians, but in their basement, you know, they had a kosher kitchen and they lit candles Friday night and they attempted to retain their Jewish customs and Jewish faith. That was the enemy of the Inquisition. So therefore the church not only opposed Jews who were Jews, they opposed Jews who said they were Christians. And that is the basis for what later becomes the racial anti-Semitism in the modern era in Europe. That comes from the fact that the church, even though it accepted converts and said if you were converted, you were a Christian, the church still suspected all the converts of not being sincere. And therefore, to a certain extent, you had the church confirm the Jewish idea that once a Jew, always a Jew. And this is the underlying point of all racial anti-Semitism. Is that there just something is being there just is something in being a Jew that when you're a Jew, so you know then you can't be helped. Nothing can help you anymore. So even if the priest sprinkles water on you, in your heart you're still a Jew. And the Nazi propaganda, the Russian anti-Semitism, all of that is based on this idea, but the idea originally was a church idea that somehow the converts were not to be trusted, and therefore that once a Jew, always a Jew. The Ashkenazim at this time, the Sephardim were more numerous than the Ashkenazim. The Ashkenazim were very small in number. It's estimated that at the time of Rashi, there probably were no more than 10,000 Ashkenazim in the world. And that's why the Ashkenazim, for instance, have a tendency towards genetic diseases, God forbid, because of the fact that if you're only 10,000 people, it means there's only like 2,500 families or 2,000 families, and they all intermarried with each other. So then over a period of time, the recessive genes become dominant, and you have all sorts of mutations and genetic diseases. And therefore, even now, when there are millions of Ashkenazim, the DNA base is still small. And that's what raises the problem. It's estimated that 80% of Ashkenazic Jewry is related somehow to the house of Rashi. So that when all the Hasidic Rebbeim say that they're descended from Rashi, they're not telling you something that's not true, because of the fact that, you know, almost all Ashkenazim, 80% have some direct familial connection with the house of Rashi. Now, Rashi and the Balei Tosfos, they flourished in France. And in France, the Jews were expelled in the 1200s, just as they were expelled from England in the 1200s. So the Ashkenazic Jews moved eastward, and they moved to Bohemia, and they moved to Germany. And that became the centers of Ashkenazic Jewry. Prague, for instance, was the main Ashkenazic Jewish city in Europe. And in Bohemia is where great scholars and great yeshivas flourished, not in our sense of a yeshiva, but in the sense of a yeshiva in the 13th and 14th century. And the Jews were in Moravia, Bohemia, in that area of Central Europe, and they were in Germany as well. Now, they were in Regensburg and Nuremberg, Frankfurt am Main. You're all ancient Jewish communities. Many of those communities go back to Roman times, when Jews came there with the Roman army. But what happened was the Black Plague, the Black Death, which occurred in the 14th century. The Black Death was the bubonic plague. But again, nobody knew. It couldn't be identified. Nobody knew what you were talking about. And people mysteriously died. So originally they died, they had to be bitten by a rat or they had to be bitten by a flea. The bubonic plague was carried to Europe by fleas that lived in the fur of rats, and every boat that docked had rats. Now, we don't want to say it today because you all go on cruises, but let's just say that problem has not been eliminated. It hasn't disappeared yet. And in the 1300s, a boat came from the east, and there was particularly infested with rats and the fleas, and it brought the bubonic plague to Europe. There was no immunity to it. There was no medicine. There's no medicine today for it either, by the way. The only medicine is that the immunity system is built up. It came in two forms. So one form was that the flea had to bite somebody. And the other form, which was more lethal and in the Middle Ages much more mysterious, was that a person by breathing in the air breathed in the virus that caused the plague. And therefore, there were no defenses against it. The 14th century is probably one of the worst centuries until we come to the 20th century in all of human history. There's a book that was written by Barbara Tuchman called A Distant Mirror, the story of the 14th century. It's a horrendous century. There was a 100 years war between France and England, all the terrible persecutions of the Jews, and this Black Death. Now, the Black Death killed 1/3 of the population of Europe, which in absolute numbers maybe is only 2 million or 3 million, you know, which by Stalin would not be numbers. But in terms of the proportion of the population, entire cities were emptied. The forest came back and reconquered farms and villages. It took Europe over 100 years to recover from it. And it went away, and no one knew why it went away, because no one knew why it came. So when something like this happens, all of humanity always looks for a scapegoat. Cannot be that, you know, it just happened. And the scapegoat in Central Europe and in Germany were the Jews. And the Jews became the scapegoat because the non-Jewish world, especially the Christian world, there were priests that preached it from the pulpit regularly. The Jews somehow poisoned the wells. The Jews put a curse on the water. They put a curse on the, so that, because the Jews in the mind of the medieval person was the devil. There's a force in the world called the devil, called Satan, Lucifer, whatever you want to call him. And this force is the Antichrist. It's against the forces of good. It's against Christianity. So it had to be the Jews. And the Jews somehow are the cause of this Black Death, of this plague that destroys most of Europe. And therefore, the cure for the plague is to get rid of the Jews. This is an oversimplification, but it's not inaccurate. And in order to get rid of the Jews, so you had pogroms, fearsome pogroms, especially in Germany. Though the Jews in Central Europe, in Bohemia, Moravia, were not spared either, but not to the extent that it existed in Germany. So to a certain extent, the Ashkenazim were in danger of disappearing. You couldn't go back to France. You couldn't go back to England. You couldn't go west. Where you were was untenable. So then the Lord provided for the Jews a new home, for the Ashkenazic Jews, a new home. Poland and Lithuania. And the Jews were invited by the kings of Poland to come to Poland, because Poland was then completely undeveloped, had no commerce, it had no monetary system. It just freed itself from the Asiatic tribes that had invaded most of Eastern Europe. And he invited the Jews, especially of Central Europe, to come east to Poland. So in the 1300s, there was a mass migration of the survivors of Ashkenazic Jewry to Poland and then to Lithuania as well. Now, Lithuania today is a small country, but Lithuania in the 14th century was an empire. The entire northern half of Poland, much of White Russia, parts of Finland, even parts of what was once Prussia, German Prussia, were all under the Lithuanian kings. And you had this organization called the Hanseatic League. The Hanseatic League was an independent today they would call it globalization. Ports on the Baltic Sea, on the North Sea, on those two seas, on those two oceans, banded together because of the fact that they knew they didn't have protection from the government, from other things, from all of the troubles. They banded together and they made a league. So it included the ports of Bergen in Norway, Oslo, ports in Germany, Bremen, in Lithuania and in Latvia, Riga. All of these ports, Stockholm, all of these ports were members of the Hanseatic League. And the Hanseatic League was to do business. That was its purpose, commerce, to do business. And in order to do commerce, Jews were always, the Jews were attracted to it, and they wanted to attract Jews to it, at least to get it started. Once it became very successful, then they tried to drive the Jews out. So the Jews came to all of these areas because they were, so to speak, invited. They were asked to come. And they came because of the fact they wanted to save their lives. If they would have stayed in Western Germany, where the pogroms were, they would have been destroyed. So the Jews, the Ashkenazic Jews, come east to Poland, and they settle in Krakow, where there was an ancient Jewish community. The Jews were in Krakow for over 900 years until the Nazis and the Poles destroyed them in the Second World War. And Krakow was a center of commerce, but it also was a center of learning. It had I think it has the oldest university in that area of the world that's many, many centuries old. It was a place of culture. It was a city, it was to Poland in the 14th century, let us say, what New York was to the United States in the latter half of the 19th and the beginning of the 20th century. It was the place that you came to. It was a place that had everything. And it had also a mixture of peoples. And in Krakow, you have the beginnings of very strong Jewish life. There are two other major cities that play a role. One is Lublin. Lublin is considered Poland, but then it was considered part of Lithuania. So Lublin was a major place where Jews came to. And then Jews came north eventually to where Vilna was, as being also a magnet for Jewish settlement. Now it's interesting to note that Sfardim also came east to Poland and Lithuania. A certain percentage of Sephardic Jews who were exiled from Spain joined the Ashkenazim. For instance, I think I've mentioned it to you before, the Torah Tmima, Rabbi Baruch Halevi Epstein, whose father was the Orach HaShulchan, the famous Rabbi Yechiel Michal Epstein, the Rav of Navaradok. So they were Levim, came from the tribe of Levi. So he writes in the introduction to his autobiography to the Makor Boruch, he writes as follows. He said, our original family name is Ben Benisti, which is a perfect Sephardic name. The Knesset HaGdola was Ben Benishti. It's like, you know, in England, like Jones or Smith. Sephardic name. I think you'll remember that one of the prosecutors in the Watergate scandal against the Nixon administration was a Jewish boy by the name of Richard Ben Benishti, who since has become a great criminal defendant lawyer in the United States. But that's the name, Sephardic name. So he said, then why are we called Epstein? So he said, because when our family left Spain, we came to the German city of Epstein. And there we became Ashkenized. one of the most interesting things in culture, in Jewish culture, and I have no explanation for it, is that when Sfardim meet Ashkenazim, so to speak, when the two cultures rub on each other, the Sfardim have a tendency to become Ashkenized. You'll see it here in Israel, right? All of the Sephardic Rosh Yeshivas go with a black Homburg and with a long black coat with two buttons in the back, right? They're all Lithuanian. I mean, Rebbe Vadya doesn't go like that, and the Rishon LeZion doesn't go like that, but most of the Sephardic Rabbonim do. They don't wear the Sephardic garb. They wear the Ashkenazic garb. And that's a tendency. That's a tendency throughout Jewish history. So what happened was that these Sfardim became Ashkenazi. So you have, for instance, famous Rabbonim in Lithuania with Sephardic names. There was a Rav Abu Yichya, Don Yichya, rather. That was a famous Rav in Lita in the early 20th century, the late 19th century. How do you get a name like Don Yichya? But it was pure Yiddish, all Ashkenazi, all the way. Because of the fact that those Sephardic Jews that came became Ashkenazi. So the Torah Tmima says that anyone whose name is Epstein and is a Levi really is a Sephardi. I don't know if we have here anybody in the audience that's whose name is Epstein and who's a Levi, but if you know somebody, right? So if you know somebody, you can tell him that his origins are Sephardic. My aunt of blessed memory, who lived here in Tel Aviv, she told me that there's a tradition in our family that we're originally Sephardim also, but we came to Lithuania 500 years ago, and we became Litvaks. But originally, we all came from Spain. We're really Sephardic in origin. And I would imagine that there are tens and tens of such families amongst the Ashkenazic Jews, maybe hundreds of families amongst the Ashkenazic Jews, that really were Sephardic in origin, but after the expulsion of the Jews from Spain, and they had to leave, so they joined their Ashkenazic brethren in this march eastward, a march eastward to Poland and Lithuania. Now, they did not come to Russia, because the Romanovs later became the dynasty, but all of the Russian czars, all of the Russian kings, all of the Russian boyars refused to allow Jews onto their territory. Holy Mother Russia. And part of the reason that it was Holy Mother Russia was because no infidels were allowed in. Only Russian Orthodox. And in fact, until the time of Peter the Great, at the beginning of the 18th century, there were no Jews in Russia. And Peter the Great, his greed for power and for territory led him to conquer most of Lithuania, the Ukraine, Poland, where there was already a large Jewish population. And his bishops, his religious advisors, told him that he shouldn't do it because of the fact that he would defile Holy Mother Russia, because now he would end up with having, 800,000-900,000 Jews under his domain. And the Russians never knew how to handle the Jews, because on one hand they were there, and on the other hand they weren't supposed to be there. And therefore this endemic anti-Semitism, which unfortunately is part of the Russian psyche, and also still exists until today, had its antecedents, had its beginnings here in the fact that no Jews were allowed to live in Russia. So the Jews were in Poland, they were in Lithuania. Now there were great rabbis that founded the Polish Jewish community. The Jews are, when they come to a country, so the first 100, 200 years, they're not really noted for scholarship or for Torah or for yeshiva. It takes a century, sometimes more than a century, to get rooted into the place. We find that in Spain, the Jews came in the 600s, the great Talmidei Chachamim didn't really start until the end of the 800s, the beginning of the 900s. And the same thing when the Jews came to France, etc., sort of, except for Rabbeinu Gershom and Worms and Mainz, there were no centers of Torah the first 100 years. We could say the same about the United States to a certain extent, that it took a century, more than took a good century for Torah to find itself in America and to be able to build up a network of education and of people, etc. And the same thing happened in Poland. So the beginnings of the Jews in Poland are not spectacular, but there's a steady Jewish migration and there are strong Jewish gehillas. So then there was Rav Reb Sholem Shachne was his name, and he in Krakow built the Krakow community, and his son-in-law was the Ramah, Reb Moshe Iserlish, who was really the pillar of Polish Jewry. He's the one who wrote the notes, the glosses to the Shulchan Aruch of Rabbi Yosef Karo, and he is the basic posek, the basic decisor of all Jewish law upon which all Ashkenazic psak is based today, is what does the Ramah say. And they created this great Jewish community in Krakow. Ramah, unfortunately, had a very short life. Legend has it that he lived only 33 years and that he wrote 33 books and that he died on Lag BaOmer. The historians say that he did die on Lag BaOmer, but that he did live into his 40s. We don't have all 33 of his books, but he was a prolific author and scholar. And he was a man of great great influence, and his influence is felt today because all of Ashkenazic Jewry still depends upon his opinions and attitudes and directions in halacha. Ramah had an uncle called Rabbi Shlomo Luria. The Ari is also called Luria. Luria is a very famous family. Luria was an Ashkenazic family. In fact, the Ari in Tzfat was called he was called on the name of Ashkenazi, Rabbi Yitzchok Ashkenazi Luria. And you'll find an interesting thing that by the Sfardim, Ashkenazi is a common name. But when you find again Sfardim who are named Ashkenazi, it means somewhere back there was a grandfather that was an Ashkenazi. Or that the people moved from Ashkenazic territory, or that they came with Ashkenazic customs. And it was a method, so to speak, of identifying people who were not pure Sfardim. Rabbi Shlomo Luria was the Rav in Lublin. So you have Lublin and Krakow as being the two major centers in Poland. And Reb Shlomo Luria was an uncle or a great uncle of the Ramah. Reb Shlomo Luria is one of the most interesting people in Jewish history. He was a very, very strong person. He brooked no nonsense from anyone. I don't know if he'd be a successful rabbi in today's world. He opposed the Shulchan Aruch. The idea of having a Shulchan Aruch, the idea of having all the halachas put down, because he said that would stifle creativity, would stifle Torah learning, nobody would learn the Gemara correctly anymore, everybody would think they just have to go to the Shulchan Aruch and look it up. He was also a tremendous scholar. You see in the back of the Gemaras, as they are published, the Vilna Shas, you see always the notes of the Marshal. He's the Marshal of Shlomo Luria. He corrected texts. He took it upon himself to say the text is incorrect. We eliminate these words. We put in other words. He had very strong shoulders. He had an enormous amount of, I wouldn't say self-confidence, but an enormous amount of strength leadership strength. We have a famous discussion between the uncle and the nephew that is in the Shilas and Tshuvas of the Ramah. So in the first, in the beginning, Dalet Hei Vav, there's a series of communications between the Marshal and between the Ramah. And it's really a very, very fascinating thing. Why? So I'll tell you something, but don't tell anyone. Okay? Well, it's just between us and the camera. In Krakow, the custom was that Jews got married on Friday afternoon. That was a custom in Eastern Europe all the time. Part of the custom was because of the fact, simply economics. Everybody got together and had the Friday night meal together. Everybody brought it. You know, that was the wedding feast. So you didn't have to, you know, you didn't have to spend $30,000 on a caterer. And also, other reasons and then Kabbalistic reasons came in, but that was the custom. I saw the custom here in Yerushalayim yet. I've attended Friday afternoon weddings because that was the custom in Eastern Europe. Well, in Krakow, they wanted to be Misameach the Chosnan Kala. They wanted to rejoice with them and dance with them. So they would hire a band. The band was made up of non-Jews. And they would play Friday night. They would play on Shabbos at the Chasana. I'm not making this up. And that was their custom. Well, the Marshal wrote to the Ramah, and he said to him, well, how can you allow such a thing? How can you allow such a thing to have, the band music played, you know, on Friday night on Shabbos? I thought he said you're a man of influence in your community, you know, and everything, you know, how can you do it?
Now,
what?
Everybody
came. Yeah, there was no this thing. Charedim, Datiim, Chilonim is all a modern invention. I mean, when I grew up, yet there weren't. There was only Jews. There was the Jews that were more. There were Jews that were less. There were Jews that were older. Jews that were younger. There were Jews that were smarter. Jews that weren't so smart. But there was no such thing as this slicing the pie the way we've invented it here. The labeling, there was no such thing as Haredim. There was no such thing as Datim, and there was no such thing as the other one, and nothing. You know, they were Jews. So all the Jews came to the wedding. And you're not talking about, again, enormous amounts of people, because these are relatively small communities yet. So the Marshal is fire. Like a volcano erupts. The Ramah is placid. Nothing gets him nervous. He writes him back, Uncle, this is the custom here. We checked it out, al pi halacha. There's really no halachic violation. It's not something to make a fight about in our community. They've been doing it. There should be more weddings amongst the Jewish people. We should always meet at happy occasions. He writes him such a letter. The Marshal goes through the roof. Not only that, he writes him back and he says, not only, what do you mean, halacha, you're wrong, you're not only that, your Hebrew's no good. He said, atom mankiv schorim, you take males and you make them females. He didn't like the Ramah's grammar, the gender, right? He said, atom maskir nekevus, and you take women and you make them schorim and you don't write right, and he writes, well, it's just something to say. And the Ramah prints the whole letter in his tshuvas, like, you know, like nothing. And he writes him back and he says, you're right, my Hebrew should be better, I'm going to try and improve, Uncle. And you know, it's one of the most fascinating correspondences between these two great pillars of Ashkenazic Jewry, of Polish Jewry, the founders of Polish Jewry. And two different types of people, two different personalities completely. And the Ramah is the one that justified the Shulchan Aruch. Just as the Marshal opposed it. He justified it. How did he justify it? Because he wrote his notes inside the text of the Shulchan Aruch. He didn't write a separate book. What he did is he took Rabbi Yosef Karo's Shulchan Aruch, which basically was Svardik in its attitude and in its following of Halacha. Rabbi Yosef Karo said that he would base it on the opinions of the Rambam and the Rif and the Rosh. Well, two of the three were, and in case of a dispute, he said he would follow the majority. Well, two of the three were Svardim, the Rif and the Rambam. The Rosh is the Ashkenazi, through the tour of the Rosh, and therefore most of his decisions reflected Svardic view of the matter. The Ramah inserted the Ashkenazic view, and he asserted it in the book. And he said, "V'onu ein noagim kach." It's not our custom to do it this way, or do we follow this, or we, you know. And again, the way he says it, it's so smooth, it's so non-controversial. It has a soothing effect upon you. You don't feel that you're involved in a controversy here. And that was his personality. That was his greatness. And there's a great story of Reb Meir of Lublin, the Lubliner of Reb Meir Shapiro in the 1920s. So he built a yeshiva building that still exists in Lublin. And it was the first major yeshiva building in Poland. The yeshivas were in Lithuania, not in Poland. In Poland, the chassidim learned in Shtiblach, but they didn't, they're in Beis Medrash, but they didn't have a... what we would call today a modern present-day yeshiva. And he came to build it, Yeshiva Chachmei Lublin. And he built a beautiful building. The building is still standing today. The Poles are using it, I think, for a veterinary school or something. It still has the gold Hebrew letters on the parapet on top.
The Nazis
used it too, yes. I mean, it's one of the architectural landmarks in Lublin. And so he had electric lights at a time when that wasn't, not everything was electrified. There are parts today in Eastern Europe that still are not electrified. He had a dormitory. He served three meals a day. I mean, you know. So one of his critics, so whenever you do something positive in the Jewish world, you always have somebody that says, "It's not right, you don't need it, or who are you? It's not a good idea." The naysayers always appear. There's nothing positive that has ever existed. It's like the Israeli Knesset. There has to be an opposition, even if it's good. Even if they agree with it, they have to oppose it. It's their duty in life.
Did the Marshal also oppose the Rambam, the Rosh, and the two other predecessors of the Shulchan Aruch?
He didn't oppose them, let's put it this way, he was not a fan of that type of a book,
of any of this. Any codification.
So he felt that sometimes you needed it because, you know, otherwise Torah would be forgotten, but he felt that the Shulchan Aruch was a leap too far. So Meir Lublin, they came to him and they said, but it says in Pirkei Avos, you know, Pas b'melech tochal, mayim b'msura tishte, al oretz atotishon, v'torah atohomel. Torah is supposed to be, you know, with a crust of dry bread, with a little bit of water, you're supposed to sleep on the floor. Here you're building this fancy building. So he answered them, he was a very, very clever Jew, to put it mildly. He answered them, he says, you know, in Shulchan Aruch it says, the Mechaber says that on the night of Pesach, you say Hallel, which is our custom here in Israel, everybody says. But in the Golis, in the diaspora, the Ashkenazim don't say Hallel. In the synagogue, they say it only at the Seder, but they don't say it in the synagogue. So the Ramah says, V'onu ein noagim kach. That's not our custom to say Hallel. So he said, you have to read it with the tremendous melody that the Ramah wrote it. The Ramah said, Nebach, onu ein noagim kach. Such a beautiful minig, and we don't have it. So he said, the same thing, you have to know how to read this. Mayim Bamsura Tishta, right, Valoritz Tishan Vatora Tohomel. You expect them to learn? If you don't give them bread, you don't give them water, you don't feed. I mean, you expect that the somehow Torah would survive. But that idea of Onu Einoagim Kach, which is the Ramah, right? The Ramah doesn't say the Machaber is wrong. He doesn't say Vein Alocha Kain. The Alocha is not like that. He doesn't say it strongly. He says it's not us. We don't just. It's not our custom. We don't do it, right? But he's not out. He's not out to prove the point. Vimdinaseinu, right? They know the knowing. In our places, we're not knowing like that. It's a great minig, but it's got nothing to do with me. So this personality is in sharp contradistinction to the personality of the Marshal. It's the combination of the two that creates Polish Jewry. It's the combination of the fire of the Marshal, because Polish Jewry was always pepper. It was always fiery. But it was also the ability somehow to slide through things always, not to be rigid, which was also the hallmark of Polish Jewry, and which enabled it, therefore, to become the home of the Jewish people. When the Jews came there, they said, Polin, here we will sleep over. Here we'll rest over the night of the exile. Polin, here we'll be able to stay over. And they stood over for many, many centuries, but it proved that, at the end, it proved not to be hospitable, which unfortunately is the story of all Jewish exiles. Thanks.